The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Thank you so much, Professor James Peterson, one of the most brilliant and gifted young intellectuals we have in this country, and I'm honored to be introduced by him tonight and count him as a dear friend, as you might be able to tell. I want to thank Sister Sarah and all the good folk here at the Free Library for giving me this opportunity to chat with you a bit tonight. It's hot up in here, so I'm not going to talk as long as I usually talk. I'm going to cut it down from an hour and a half to an hour and 29 minutes. It's a great privilege to be here tonight, back in Philly. And what a wonderful city. What a wonderful group of people you are. Got a new attorney general up in here, I see. In Philadelphia, African-American, man, what's breaking out? The Obama effect, breaking out all over. But it's an honor to be here in Philly, and appropriately to talk about the ideas gathered in my book, Can You Hear Me Now? Now, this book gathers together some of my favorite quotes and passages from my work over the last 20 years that people have expressed interest in that I thought might reflect on my beliefs and values about a whole range of subjects, from race and identity to homosexuality and homophobia to black music to hip-hop culture to Barack Obama to race, poverty, and class and the like. So obviously I can't talk about all that stuff. And people are always asking me, well, give us an introductory book, man, because, you know, you got this work and that work. What's a good introduction to your work? So I produced this as a kind of précis, a snapshot of my thinking on a variety of subjects. I might change my mind next week and not like any of it, but that's what I'm thinking so far along this passageway and this pathway. That's why I tell people, when you read the Bible and close it, you ain't, if you're a Christian, you haven't shut God's mind or God's mouth. If God is still alive and God's still speaking, if we believe God is, or if you follow the Holy Quran, when you close the Quran, you have not shut Allah's mouth or mind if God is still speaking, if Allah is still articulating. If you are a Unitarian, when you close Ralph Waldo Emerson or Henry David Thoreau or Socrates, you may have closed the book, but the presence of the thought is still resonant and residing within. So I'm just honored to be here to talk a bit about what I used to think and what I have thought and what I continue to think about a broad variety of subjects. So I'm going to talk about 10, 15 minutes, and then we'll have Q&A where we get a chance to engage one another. Then we'll have a chance to us to sign a few books. This book, Can You Hear Me Now, of course, is Can You Hear Me Now? Because I've been saying stuff for a while. I want to repackage it and see if you can hear me now. But can you hear me now? In this age of Obama, in this age of prosperity, of thought, if not in the economy, because we know we're living in tough times. But I'll pick three subjects about which I discourse in this book and upon which I have reflected, and then talk about them and then open it up. Of course, I'll start with President Barack Obama. What a magisterial moment in the history of American society, in the evolution of American democracy, to have an extraordinary figure like Mr. Obama ascend to the presidency. The fact that we have brains back in the White House is an extraordinary thing. Right? Just not black or white, but gray. That's important. Gray matter. And if you can think and be sexy with your thinking, or make thinking sexy, not whether or not Barack has a nice body when you see him on the beach, I'm sure he does. I'm talking about whether he can make the life of the mind sexy, which he has done. People, young kids say to each other, when they're messing up, watch out, Barack's in the office. Right? And instead of saying, how you doing, they say, what's Barack? Very interesting. Already, with school kids, it has trickled down, this sense of excellence. And even though I think it's distorted when people say, even among African-American kids, they say, we have no more excuses than African-American people. We have no more excuses because Barack Obama is president. It's a marvelous thing. Now, I think it's distorted because when you go down to the Dominican Republic and you find a cat that can hit the ball out the park, you don't say to the Dominican people, no more excuses for you. Right? You say to the other major league teams, go get some more Dominican dudes who can strike the ball out the park. Right? So with Barack Obama, what we're trying to say is there's more where that came from. Right? He ain't the only one. Oh, he good. He ain't even the coldest. Right? There's somebody warming up in the bullpen right now. Right? We don't even know. Getting ready to get born. Might be toiling right now. If he's Jackie Robinson, I can't wait to see Willie Mays. All right. So what's interesting, hey, let's just deal with this Negro first. Oh, I hear you. And so that too. I use Negro in a pejorative sense, not. But in an affectionate sense, which is my license as a black man born as a Negro. So when I articulate that, if you got a kind of fundamentalism about racial apologetics, then I'm sorry, but you will be offended tonight. All right. So for me, and I say that acknowledging Malcolm's birthday yesterday, May 19th, right? He said so-called Negro. I like that. So I put it in scare quotes by saying it the way I do. My voice's intonation is the, if you will, approximation of Mr. X's attempt to put it in scare quotes, if you understand what I'm saying. So for me, when I look at a Barack Obama, I say no more excuses for those of us who are out here, but no more excuses for the society. You say you can't even find a CEO to run a Fortune 500 company. We done found a brother to run America. So no more excuses. Now black folk can run NASA, maybe even become head of the NBA. No disrespect to David Stern, that's my man. I still want tickets from you, David. If you're listening to this, I love you. Maybe a black woman can become president. Maybe Michelle Obama's presidency is going to be off the chains. See, that's what we mean. You give them an inch, they want to take a mile. Right. We ain't got a taste of power. We want to turn it out now. So it is extraordinary that there are no excuses for African-American people who say, look, I don't want to dream big because now dreaming big pays off in huge dividends. No excuses to America that says I can't find one. I can't find out and figure out what one looks like. And no excuses to Mr. Obama. You up in the office. You are the man. So to speak, it's weird for black people to say we demand. We used to be in Moses. We ain't used to being Pharaoh. Oh, but we be pharaonic right now. And that means then that there's some space for internal criticism, despite riding with Mr. Obama to the wheels fall out, Dr. Peterson. What's interesting, though, that's critical, because I rode with Obama to the wheels fell off. You know, in terms of campaigning for him, because I believed he was the best person for the job. And he's done an extraordinary job in the first 100 and so days he's been in office. I mean, you know, they hand black people the ship when it's sinking. Hey, let's get a Negro, because I think this is a good time. Hey, it's called the Titanic. Come on. But that's all right. Black people say, it's good to have a black man in the presidency right now when the economy messed up. What did Tupac say? Brother, know how to make a dollar out of 15. Yeah. He got money in the mattresses up in the Lincoln bedroom. So the thing is, Obama is an extraordinary man by any measure. Don't just say he's an extraordinary black man. He's an extraordinary American. Right? We should hold him high in prayer. We should hold him in high esteem, and we should hold him accountable. People can't wrap their minds around that. It's no. We love him. You love your kids too. But you want him to do right. You don't say, I love my kid, I can't discipline him. No, that's not love. I don't want to beat the crap out of him. I don't mean that now. Direct this toward black people in particular. We're going to have to let the white folk off the hook tonight. Black people be killing them. I'm going to beat you to a floating opportunity. Right? Black folk, that's what's wrong with white folk. Their kids just do everything and run crazy. I'm going to kill you. You killing the self-esteem. You killing the initiative. You're killing the belief that they can do anything because you got them so disciplined. And I understand why, because you didn't want the society to beat them down. So in compensation for and anticipation of what society might do, you administer your judgment in vicious terms. And yet, what happens? The consequences are somewhat perilous. And so I ain't talking about that kind of discipline. I'm talking about discipline in terms of direction. I'm talking about discipline in terms of shaping them, loving them enough to say, you're doing good, you're doing well, you're doing right, but you're doing wrong, you can do better. So in order for us to love Obama, we ain't got to act like we don't, you know, disagree with him. I disagree with some things with President Obama. I didn't say much when I was campaigning for him. Now he's in office. That's the time to talk. Not to beat up. Now, people say, you're hating. Come on. I knew Barack Obama when most of you Negroes wasn't even checking for him. Now black people are so protective of a guy that 97% of them didn't vote for to begin with. They were with Hillary Clinton. I'm not mad. Don't let me call the roll, though. Don't make me say that. Don't make me prove that you were not with him. You were calling him Barack Obama. And not until white people proved they would support him did some of you start supporting him. When he went to Iowa, before then, he was having a tough time with black people. Then he went there and won Iowa. Black people said, ain't but four Negroes in Iowa. White folk gave their approval, then black folk got along. You can understand why Mr. Obama might be a bit reticent and reluctant to altogether uncritically embrace. And, of course, we understood what that was about. That wasn't simply about judging him. It was about to say, we know if a black man can't get the white folk to vote for him, then it ain't no use of voting for him because we're throwing our vote away. I get that logic. But the reality is 97% of black people ultimately ended up voted for Mr. Obama. Not nearly as many in terms of percentage white people did. So when they tell you, well, without white people, Mr. Obama couldn't become president, they're technically right. But without black people, he would have never made it to the White House. So why is it that black people think that they ought to exempt Mr. Obama from requirement? That's not to diss him. That's not to hate on him. That's to say, if you're the president, we put you in office, we expect stuff of you. Now, we're going to give you a longer leash. Because we just glad to see one of us up in there. See a brother coming down Air Force One. What's up? Yeah, we... That's priceless, right? That's priceless when you see him. Flash that smile. That's priceless when he goes to Ben Chili Bowl. Y'all don't know nothing about Ben Chili Bowl, but up in D.C. The news media tracks him there. The Washington Post said that when he went up into the Ben Chili Bowl with Adrian Fenty, the mayor of Washington, and he gave the woman some money, the cashier, and upon her asking, shall I return to you any change? The Washington Post said, Mr. Obama said, no, we're straight. Now, that wasn't an unconscious or inadvertent proclamation about sexual orientation. But that ain't what he said. See, he didn't say, no, we're straight. You see, in black vernacular, especially in black English, there are zero copulas. Copula is a form of the verb to be. So there's no, we're straight. He said, nah, we straight. That's different, y'all. Don't make me bring Dr. Peterson up here and deconstruct as an English professor what that means in AEEV, you know, African American English vernacular. Black talk, black English. No, we straight. In other words, I'm giving you the hookup. I don't want the people to scrutinize what I'm doing for a gift. I'm just trying to give you an early Christmas present. No, you ain't got to return the change. No, we straight. So I love it when he engages in these moments of high signification that sometime pass the test of African-American identity without scaring off other people because they're so fast they don't get it. And he just sneaks it on in, bringing Earth, Wind, and Fire to the White House. Ah, reasons, the reasons that we're here. Ain't up in no George Bush White House. Stevie Wonder, a boy is born in Hartown, Mississippi, surrounded by four walls that ain't so pretty. Go to school. So that's different just right there. And then Michelle Obama rolling up in the spot. What? That's the new arms race. Looking just what spectacular. Some say that, what? I mean, it's just crazy, right? I mean, Michelle Obama, tall, dark-skinned. No disrespect to yellow people like myself. Yellow is still mellow when we can get around, fellow. We used to be in style in the 80s. We haven't been since. But that's cool. Now you got the dark-skinned black people on display. And a lot of black women dug Obama because he got a black-skinned woman. Ain't no harm to nobody else. We ain't dissing nobody else. But you know black women have been subordinated in the hierarchy of beauty in American society. She is tall, intelligent, brilliant, went to Princeton and Harvard from the south side of Chicago, and she got a shape. Let's just say she's a shape of things to come. Even the queen had to say, oh, my God. Can I tell? Obama probably said, oh, I feel the same way. Go on. Reach out and touch you for a minute. But if it's longer than that, I'm going to have to charge you. So here it is that Michelle Obama, and I know they've mommified her. That's cool. Mom in chief, that's her. I get that. Because she wants to redeem the negative portrayals of black women as non-mothers, the welfare queen, all the vicious calumny that's been heaped upon black women's heads. I get that. But she was making mad loot and major cheddar before her husband became president. She was the breadwinner, too. And so to see that black family with those two black girls there, so beautiful in the White House on the swing with they dog living in public housing. But it's nice public housing. It's a beautiful picture. So the worth and value of Obama is to the future. The little kids who wake up every day and they see the dude in charge is like them, from their tribe, from their clan, from their part of the world. And in case many white brothers and sisters don't understand that, you done had 43. This is the first one. We just trying to get used to it. I wake up some morning and say, is the president a brother? Is that like for real? Is a black man the president of the United States? Don't let that be me. I'll be up in there with Michelle if that was my wife. We're like, can you believe it? Salute me, baby. I'm going to put my presidential on. I'll be there. I'm the president. I'm the president. What's up? But of course, he's not me. He got dignity, real cool, very balanced. But that's a throwback, too. Because there was a time when black people had to be that way. We know the first always had to be that way. Jackie Robinson couldn't get mad when people stepped on his feet with their cleats. He had to outperform them. Now, that's ridiculous because a lot of those white ball players weren't playing against the best. They were playing against the best white ball players. Right? That's different. Larry Bird playing Bob Cousy. But face LeBron James. Or my man Kobe Bean Bryant. Still the best. I know LeBron's coming, but slow down. Who do you want with the ball at the end of the game? Kobe. You saw it last night. So you can't just, I know I mix sports there. I get it. Baseball versus basketball. I get that. Right? But Babe Ruth wasn't playing against the best ball players. He was playing against the best white ball players who were allowed to play. Because Josh Gibson and Josh White weren't allowed to play. Hitting 899 home runs. So my point simply is, let's allow fair competition to prevail in order to judge the worth or merit of a particular individual performance. And it means that, but also these firsts have to be careful. So Barack Obama is a throwback to an earlier racial epic when Negroes had to be pacific and pacifistic and very particular and controlled and calm, because that's the only way he was going to roll up in there. And this is true right now. Can't be an angry Negro. Can't roll up in there getting your Sharpton and Jackson on. And I ain't mad because I love Sharpton and Jackson. Right? Ain't no either or. I'm just saying, but we know that couldn't win. That ain't no disrespect to them. That's America's immaturity. It wasn't ready to take the full compliment. Black people can't play Dr. Phil on TV. Can you imagine? Are you crazy? Have you lost your damn mind? You know, brother, that ain't gonna go over. We talking to some white woman from Texas? I think you are plumb out of your mind, baby. That ain't going well on the Nielsen ratings. White man can do that. Dr. Phil can be Dr. Phil. Can't be no brother, Dr. Mike. What? You better for shizzle my nizzle, your bizzle on the stizzle. Sit your butt down. Act like you got some damn sense and come at me when you know what you're talking about. That's not going over. And so my point is, my brothers and sisters, Mr. Obama was cool, calm, and collected, beautiful, composed, with a sense of grace, elan vital. And that's beautiful. Doesn't make him perfect or a messiah. Makes him a president of extraordinary capacity. And black people must learn to balance out our appreciation for his genius and what he has done, and also to hold him accountable. Mr. Obama cut $85 million in the budget for historically black colleges and universities that George Bush kept for 2 years. I think he deserves critique. Now, we got powerful reasons that have been recently explained to me, and I won't repeat them in case they deny my argument. But what's interesting, it seems to me, is that if we're going to hold Bush accountable, and a brilliant point was made by Dr. Peterson, that Bush's capital rose when he invested in that program, and they look at a black man, you're trying to help the black colleges. But there's no excuses for Barack Obama. You are now the president. I know you want a second term and you have to be careful. I get that. But don't release all of your energy into the effort to deflect race as opposed to embrace the edifying dimensions of race that can be seen and perceived as universal. Because I get the fact that you can't be doing the specific and the particular at the expense of the universal in terms of people's perception. And you got to be cool with yours. And he is that. But also at the same time, we must ask him, if we were mad at George Bush for not going to the United Nations Conference on Racism, and black folk wore George Bush out, bless his heart. He sent a low-level person, then they withdrew early. How come we ain't said nothing about Mr. Obama's failure to send anybody to the UN Conference on Racism? Most black folk are going to say, look, that's important, Dyson, but slow down, son. If that's all he's doing wrong, that's my man. I get that. And in many ways, I agree. But I'm saying to you, there's got to be a balance. You can't be talking about it, because at the end of the day, if all we get for a black person being in the presidency is the fact that we could say it was one of us who was there, but the substance of the argument was lost, and the public policies that we had invested in for years and decades as a civil rights movement have been strangled, then we have lost ultimately. And so we must think about what that compromise is. At the same time, I know why Mr. Obama's getting mad love. I got mad love for him. We're going to give him a long honeymoon, maybe for the first 8 years. And then in the ninth year, we're going to start criticizing him. Oh, he's out of office then. Cool. Right? So the point is, how do we balance that out without being seen as haters on the one hand and yet lovingly affirming of what he does while being critical at the same time? And so I talk about that. Number two, I talk a bit about homosexuality and homophobia. Now, that goes over like a brick cloud in most churches and temples and synagogues, and this is where black people start to glaze over. How long will he be talking about that? I'm going to check my messages. Can't get no service in the free library. You might have to listen. Now, black people are all upset about, I'm in D.C., you know, Marion Barry, bless his heart. He the only person voted against gay marriage. Right? He the only holdout. He said he was supporting it when he was mayor. But now that he's a congressman from the South Northeast, representing the Bloods, not the Crips. He has to be responsible to them. Okay. And I said, and you thought Marion Barry wasn't against crack. Oh, I don't make the news. Now, you mean to tell me black folk got the nerve to tell somebody who to get married to? Oh, they come on my program. Well, there are books in the schools called Heather Has Two Moms. I said there's an unofficial text, too, called Shaniqua Got Four Baby Daddies. Now, you know I've been defending Shaniqua against Mr. Cosby. You know my stilo. You know I don't believe in the demonization of black women. I was a teen father myself. How am I going to be lying and saying something against somebody else? Right? So I ain't saying it for that. I'm saying, but for real, though, there are a lot of non-traditional family arrangements in black America for us to chill out on the I'm against marriage of gay people. Because you need to get your stuff set first, right? You need to do your stuff right first before you toss and toss and stones. It's amazing to me gay people even want to get married after they've seen what heterosexuals done with it. I mean, I look in the mirror at myself and then look at what we heterosexuals have done with marriage, and I'm saying, you want to get married? That restores my faith in marriage. I say, it must be something to it then. Let me go try to do it right. I mean, that's amazing that y'all free now. You ain't got to do it. You know, you got an out. You got a pass. You're a monopoly. Pass marriage. You don't have to do it. They're letting you out. Man, take advantage of that. I mean, why should heterosexual people be the only happy people? Let gay people get married. If you're against gay marriage, don't marry a gay person. Now, I ain't got but a few minutes left, but I'm going to say this. See, I know y'all be going to the Bible, the Quran, and the Tao Te Ching, the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, your favorite hip-hop song, trying to justify homophobia. Well, we're not homophobic. We have just religious views. I saw those ministers down there with Mary and Barry. I'm standing in the name of God. Wish they go down there when black people killing each other. Wish they go down there when the homicide rate is rising. Wish they would go down there and stand on God's principles when racial profiling is going on. I was in a restaurant the other night. This is not a lie. In New York City. I ain't going to call their name because I love that restaurant. I want to go back. They was for sure banned my black butt from there. High class. Trust me when I tell you this. Last time I was in there, I was hanging out with Carmelo Anthony and T.I. Get my point? Serious restaurant. Along with a bunch of other rich white people. I'm in the restaurant. They took me downstairs. I thought, oh, this is one of them, you know, get my racial hypersensitivity on. What, you taking me down to the basement? Behind the kitchen? Barack is president! They took me downstairs, place I ain't never been. Then into a room with curtains. Walked in there. Group of white women celebrating their birthday on this side. White couple right here. Two white couples right there. And we sat right there. Little private room. Upstairs was so loud you couldn't hear nothing. They're playing the best Stravinsky, Tchaikovsky, Beethoven. But we sat downstairs, and before we knew it, when the Remy's in the system, ain't no telling when I love them, when I diss them, that's what they be yelling, I'm a pimp by blood, not relation. Y'all still chase some, I'll replay some, huh? Weather's got, I mean, right there. I was like, oh, bet. The white woman over there kicking the lyrics. It's like, I'm in heaven. White women reciting lyrics from black men and speaking about their lethal sexual ferocity without complaint. This is great. And then the couple to our left. You know you can't smoke in New York nowhere, up in no public or private space, right? You can't smoke in no restaurant. Pull out a joint. Now I'm sitting over there going, I know that ain't no joint. I have seen them before. I have done ethnographic research. I know what they smell like and look like. My man whips out his joint. This is no, I was like, damn! Do you have a joint? To myself, I didn't say that out loud. He lights it up. The waiter comes in and changes it from, this is no lie, from Jigga to Tupac. I want to be your N-I-G-G-A. While he's smoking a joint. And I'm sitting there going, it's a beautiful thing to be white in America despite Obama being in the White House. Now, if a brother had lit up a joint, not lit up, lit up. I can't even imagine. I'm scared to say joint in public. Because the police might arrest me. I'm scared to even say marijuana. I stretched the word out so long that it seems like two complete different ideas. I say Mara. Hey, have you seen Juana over there? So, when you talk about forms of privilege and what goes on and who's able to do what, it does strike me that we're living in a different world predicated upon these distinctions. And to get back to my main point after regaling you with that story, my point even about the privileges we exercise as heterosexuals in a world where we have dominated the discourse and conversation and made it look as if our viewpoints, we appeal to the same scriptures and the same books and the same texts that were used to justify our manipulation, domination, and oppression. And we have no sense of irony about it. And I'm saying live and let live. Love and let love. You ain't God. Well, it's their choice to be gay. Really? So did you choose to be heterosexual? At 7, you went to your mother, look, I've been having some feelings lately. And I want you to get that Corvette ready when I turn 16. Because I'm going to be macking the ladies straight up. I need a black book, an iPhone, and an iPod. Is that what you really did? Did you actually set out to be heterosexual? Did you know what even it meant? And so for me, and my own understanding, is that we can't afford to be beaten up on nobody because the mystery of sexuality is so deep and profound and elusive that we don't know. My Bible tells me, love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, mind, and soul. Love thy neighbor as thyself. Ain't no asterisk. Ain't no except. It's just that. Now, if you want to make a distinction about, well, we don't want to call it marriage, whatever. It's a union of people who love each other. And at the end of the day, isn't that more important than anything else? Any other bond? I'll end on hip hop because I'm done. I'm going to take 1 minute to talk about hip hop because I talk so much about it. You know what I think about it. There are a lot of differences in hip-hop, three different generations maybe within hip-hop now. The difference between Superman Nat Ho versus, Rakim, it's a big difference. But here's the interesting point. A lot of people who make that point now weren't appreciating Rakim when Rakim was here. That's part of the problem. You didn't love it when it was here. Now you're nostalgic for the thing you rejected. Right? Isn't that interesting? Imperialistic nostalgia, one anthropologist calls it. Imperialistic nostalgia, or nostalgic empire, too. So that you beat up on people and destroy their culture and then grieve with them over its destruction. And so now here we are, when hip-hop was at its height, Dr. Peterson introduced me by referring to Chuck D and his statement about Minister Farrakhan. Don't tell me that you understand until you hear the man. Well, when that was out, he was being criticized. When political rap was out, it was being criticized. When nationalistic rap was out, it was being criticized. And then hip-hop took a turn toward the gangster, and then took a turn toward the materialistic. And now people are saying, what about that music that means something about politics? Well, when it was around, older people were saying, it's just crap. Turn it down. We don't want to hear it. Turn down the noise. I'm not suggesting that, therefore, the people who you are criticizing are let off the hook, or that you don't have legitimate critiques of them. I am suggesting, however, that when the music was at its height politically, you were not checking for it. Elvis was a hero to most, but he never meant shit to be straight up racist. The sicker was simple and plain. Man, John Wayne. Already I'm like, now Chuck D did say, hey, Elvis did have love for black people and artists, and he was supportive. He said, but I still give the middle finger to John Wayne. When Mos Def said, you can laugh and criticize Michael Jackson if you want to. Woody Allen molested and married his stepdaughter. Same press kicking dirt on Michael's name. Show Woody and Sun Yat at the playoff game holding hands. Now sit back and think about that. Would he get the same dap if his name was Woody Black? OJ acquitted by a jury of his peers. They've been messing with that brother for the last 10 years. Is it fair? Is it equal? Is it just? Is it right? Do we do the same thing if the defendant's face is white? White boys doing it well as suspect. Success. I start doing it well as suspect. They say they want you successful, but then they make it stressful. You start changing pace. They start changing up the tempo. Well, all I'm saying, and I'm ending here, there's a lot of good stuff in hip-hop and a lot of bad stuff, but you know there's a lot of good stuff in gospel and a lot of bad stuff too. Some of the whack stuff in gospel too. Just because you're saying Jesus don't make it good. In fact, you know what pisses me off? When people get converted from the devil and they go to God and they give God the worst beats. The devil literally has the hot beats. I mean, why is that? You get converted and you get whack. Be good for God too. Don't let the devil have all the best beats. And then you got whack stuff and God, Jesus will never say no. Stop lying. He told you no. Hell no. And I ain't gonna say it, but one time I heard Jesus go, nigga, please. Touch your white neighbor and say, don't repeat that at risk of your life. So I'm saying, y'all, is that are we gonna say it's good because it's of a particular orientation, secular versus sacred, and I'm gonna shut up here and Miss Sarah's gonna come up here and we're gonna have some questions and answers. I mean, is it really that simple? I mean, that's why I like Mary doing that. Sounding like T-Pain and my man Jamie Foxx. Blaming on the alcohol. Blaming on the Henny. You know you like that song. Don't even act like I mean, what's wrong with that? Ain't nothing wrong with it, right? Unless, you know, the problem is that the content is compromised, contorted, distorted, and therefore undermines our ability to have high-quality art. And my argument would be then that we sleep on a lot of stuff that's great. There's a lot of stuff that's very good in hip hop. Some of it is great and a little bit of it is genius. Like in about the same proportion as any other music. R&B, country, classical, jazz. And so for me, I say, let's take young people seriously. Let's not diss them. Talking about their pants. I know it's bad to sag. I get it. Unless you live in Sag Harbor. I get it. But I ain't gonna spend my, and I, all reason is bad because it's too much ventilation for me. I just can't sag. I just feel exposed. My drawers ain't clean. I don't wanna, didn't get a chance to clean the BVDs and somebody looking, is that a spot on his behind? That's, That's what they be seeing with me. Is that a dark spot? What is that? So I can't even sag right. And I tell my son, sag on your own time. Sag after hours. Have an after hours sag race. See who can run fastest from the police with your drawers hanging down. But when you go to work, sell out. Hi, how are you? Fine, how are you? Yeah. By Jiminy Christmas, I love that Doris Day. Que sera, sera. Whatever will be. Oh, I love it. I still have a job. Thanks. Now I'm being facetious. Won't you be yourself? Roll up into your spot. If you can change it, like my man Roland Martin, he's going up on CNN every night. He got him singing alcohol. Do your thing. I ain't mad at none of that. I'm just saying at the same time, don't be stupid, dumb, or ignorant about when the appropriate time is for you to express yourself. And don't act like people ain't judging you differently. And the question, see, because you can't go up in the restaurant and smoke no joint. I don't care. They offered to me. I said, hell no. I said, I don't know how to spell marijuana. I don't know what it looks. You're probably a narc. I detest marijuana. But if you're not a narc, put it in a bag and slip it to me for later. Then I'll give it to Dr. Peterson. So my point is, I'm just being serious. No, what I'm saying. And share some with Sarah. So my point to you is that we got to have an open mind about what we're doing when we're dissing our kids and stop dissing them. If you deal with their sagging aspirations and you can raise them, maybe you can raise the pants too. Maybe if you can deal with their sense of self-esteem and connection to the broader world, you can deal with that. That's some of the stuff I talk about. I'm going to end right now. We'll take a couple minutes of questions before we do a book signing. Thank you all so very much.
Hi, everybody.
Thank you. That's so kind. Thank you.
Hello. Hi. We have a couple folks in the aisles who have microphones. So if you have a question for Dr. Dyson, we will get through as many as we can quickly because we've only got about 10 minutes. So if you raise your hand, we'll get a mic to you. There's one right on the aisle there.
Sarah.
Excuse me, not me. Oh.
Yeah,
it was him. I'm sorry.
Oh, you hurt my feelings.
Okay, Oprah, come on.
How you doing, Mr. Dyson?
How you doing?
I'm a current student at Youth Philadelphia Charter School, and they help dropout youth come back to school and do what they have to do and get what they got to get to be successful in life. Mm-hmm. And my question to you was, because I am part of that SAG now in time.
I ain't mad at you. SAG on. After hours.
My question to you is because it's a concern to me that my youth, like my generation, is actually like killing each other off. Not saying like other past generations wasn't doing the same thing, but my generation is real confused. And how can we get that confusion into a better reality into this world? Like,
yeah, no, that's a great point, sir. Great point. Great point. Well, first of all, you got to learn to love yourself. Now, that sounds trite. Sounds real simple. But love is the unconditional affirmation of the existence of a human being put forward by fragile beings who are similarly in search of such unconditional affirmation. But we're all the time falling short. We judge, we harshly condemn, we indict, and the like. Also, the society gives an assist. You know, when you're on the basketball court and you don't score, but you give it to somebody else and they score, right? We give an assist to people who hate us by our beliefs and our self-hatred, our self-loathing. And we're taught by society not to really think about ourselves too well, right? I mean, it's a real struggle. The reason I made much about Michelle Obama is because dark-skinned black women still are not getting the kind of love and support that they deserve. People still, I was at a book signing last week, and a beautiful brown-skinned girl, after I had made my public affirmation of her, said that, and she was 20 years old, she said that a boy told her that light-skinned women have better faces and dark-skinned women have better bodies. Now, first of all, what kind of anthropological suspect analysis? Let's just deal with the aesthetics of that first. How ridiculous is that? But let's deal with the self-hatred and the categorization of women like you got a good face and you light-skinned it because that means you adhere more proximately to white standards. Now, I'm not dogging. Listen here. Blue eyes and blonde hair, that's beautiful. Or it can be. But it ain't the only beauty. Having your locks and your dreads and your big brown nose is beautiful, too. Right? So we ain't dissing nobody. But we saying there's more than one standard of beauty. And even in black folk, now we got to, if you look whiter and brighter and lighter, used to be that you were going to be taken. Because it'd be interesting to see if Barack Obama was his wife's color. Could he really have gotten in? It'd be interesting to see. Y'all, you know, it ain't easy to say, yeah. That's why Clarence Thomas pissed right now. I ain't got time to break that down.
We have
some of my white brothers and sisters might be, what the hell? What does that have to do with anything? He mad. Because they got dog. We got dog when he was a dark-skinned black man. Right? If you look at now on HBO, I love Muhammad Ali. Man, I do. But I am ashamed after watching The Thriller in Manila and seeing what he did to a man from this state, from this city, Joe Frazier. Joe Frazier, one of the great American heroes of the 20th century, who helped Ali out when he couldn't get a fighting contract, when he couldn't get in the ring, gave him money. And Ali got up in there and called him a gorilla. And that vicious invective that he put. So my point is, you got to think good about yourself. You got to learn to love yourself. You got to fight and combat the stereotypes of the broader society that you internalize. And that if they think you ain't good and you watch TV more than anybody else, black people watch disproportionately more television than Latinos more than anybody else, Latinos after us, then we got to figure we internalizing the same poison and we don't have a guard on it. That's why it's very difficult for us to not monitor our children if we can or next generation. So I think we got to stop doing all that stuff, stop hating ourselves, start loving ourselves, start getting together with other people who are positive, and then figure out a way to become all we can be together. That's what I think. There's a lot more, but I'll stop there.
Our next question is right on the aisle here.
How you doing, Dr. Dyson? A couple of weeks ago, a Columbia University professor by the name of Mark Thompson came out with an op-ed piece in the New York Times entitled The End of the University as We Know It, mm-hmm. where he outlined seven strategies that called for a radical restructuring of the academy in terms of thinking about the abolishment of tenure and thinking about the integration of particular departments to focus more specifically on not necessarily particular ways of thinking, but solving particular problems in a mm-hmm. very particular kind of way. And so he suggests that instead of thinking about, publications or thinking about the use of citations in certain kind of ways, let's think about how to solve the global crisis of how to use water.
Mm-hmm.
If you had control of the university system, you alone, what kind of radical restructuring would you call for in the academy? And how would that help advance, our way of
yes, sir.
Being incorporated into the academy, let's say, 10 years from now?
Yes, sir. Now, that's a great question. Whose student is that? That's Peterson's student. And he was Dyson's student even before. But, that's a brilliant point, Dr. Peterson's student. First of all, I'd make Peterson my educational czar. That's what I would do. For real, though. That's really true. Cause he's my henchman in many regards. And he's a brilliant guy. And I think, we could rethink some of the, if I were in control by myself, I get the argument about abolition of tenure since, I'm 50 years old and hopefully they won't abolish it before I get to retirement age. I can say the hell with it. I got tenure the year after I got a PhD. So I got it pretty quick and in an unusual fashion. I won't bore you with the details. So I was breaking tenure down for a long time ago for what it was, the accretion of certain credentialing capacities and capabilities that I subverted by the very temerity of doing it with such velocity and speed. I was trying to challenge it at the same time because I didn't write no books to have other people who write books read the books. I actually wanted people to read the books, not other people in the academy who sneer, snide, condescend. If you can speak to more than five people, then damn, what's wrong with you? And I get this abolition of tenure based upon, you know, not citations and books, although I'd rather take it from somebody who's written a whole bunch of books and got a whole bunch of citations to take it down so it won't look like sour grapes. Like you couldn't get the books into citations, so you're going to be against it. Right? Let me see somebody's written 15, 20 books say that. Then I'm impressed. Right? And, you know, the footnote has a peculiar history in American historiography, American letters, and the capacity of the academy to document and literally leave record and traces of its internal struggle. For instance, in my book on Martin Luther King Jr., I do a lot of work in the footnotes deliberately because I don't want that stuff to be on the page where people can assault me easily. And I know they ain't going to read the footnotes, so I bury it there. And then 25 years later when they read them, oh, it was right. Oh, my God. Right? So, because footnotes have a particular, and citations have a particular function. I don't think of it as either or, right? Because one of the ways in which we want to get eradicate citation and footnotes is to eradicate the hard work it takes to acknowledge somebody else's idea. Could be you want to hate on the origin of it. Now, I know that Professor Thompson doesn't mean that, but that's the use to which it could be put. All ideas are equally available and accessible to a public domain because they are equally capable of being adjudicated. No, not really. People have to make decisions. One of the great things about the Internet is that everybody can be a publisher. One of the worst things about the Internet is that everybody can be a publisher. I mean, we got people saying crazy stuff, right? Just because you can say it don't mean we need to hear it. Although it has democratized the space. So I think that Professor Thompson makes some provocative points, especially about solving problems. What I try to do as a public intellectual is help people solve problems by thinking critically about the most powerful crises of our time in public in ways that help people facilitate a transition from one stage of thinking to another and to shed light and bring clarity to very obscure and difficult problems. And so I think it's very important what Professor Thompson would recommend. And if I were in charge, I would make it possible for students to, yes, be serious learners and serious teachers. I'd have a much more flexible interaction between the two. The Don system, right, in England is one. When you go to Oxford and you sit, you know, meet with your professor every couple of weeks, you all break it down, you read the book, not the Don Corleone, where the teacher is like the master. But in the sense of a co-learner, because if you're really doing it right as a teacher, you're learning much more from your students than you can ever impart to them if you're doing it right. And so if I was in charge, I'd have a system more closely akin to that. And then I would have it free. I mean, the biggest thing we can do for folk is to make education free. Because there are a whole lot of folk who deserve to go to the big schools and do the thing. Because the arguments we have about education is over the top 25 elite institutions and the top 25%. The rest of 75% of these educational institutions, a lot of people can get in. We don't really argue about them. And so I would let people into all educational institutions who had the capacity to learn. And that would change up the game. See, what's interesting to me, they're having a conversation right now, and I end here, California, where Asian brothers and sisters are pissed because the change in rule will mean that a lot fewer of them will be able to get into college. Because, see, white brothers and sisters, when it came to black people, hey, let your chips fall where they may. If you can't get in, tough. But then when the Asians start kicking the white people's behind, hey, we got to stop it. Got to change the rules. They say they want you successful, but then they make it stressful. You start keeping pace. They start changing up the tempo. So now we got a radical rethinking of the educational criteria by which we adjudicate and dispense access to meritorious performance. Right. Too many Asians up in there whipping white people's ass. Because if that's the case, it's going to be totally Asian. See? So when you begin to look at it that way, then you begin to see that from the very beginning, the question of what merit is complex. And so, for me, I would make it available to all people who were smart to be able to roll up in there, and people not so smart to be able to roll up in the schools that they can be educated by, because in the ultimate sense of the thing, some people are slow beginners and fast finishers. So we got to provide opportunity for everybody who wants to be educated. I didn't go to college until I was 21 to be educated. I didn't go to college until I was 21. So I tried to make up for lost time, and I'm sensitive to that. So I think that there are many things I would do along those lines, class-wise, making it poor Appalachian whites to be able to go to college. A lot of smart people out there can't even get into school. Down in the Delta, Latinos and the immigrant population, we punishing them. Let's not punish them. Let's open up our doors. Let's have as much bright and intelligent people as we can. So that's what I would do off the top of my head there, brother. Great question, though, Professor.
We've Future. Actually come to the end of the time that we have for questions. I'm sorry. We'll have lots more time for questions in the line upstairs. There's books for sale, but can we give a round of applause to Dr. Dyson?
I love you.
Thank you for being
you.
Here.
That means, sir.
Please join us upstairs in the lobby for the book signing.
Better you than me.
Trying to keep you on track.
I love you, baby. You know I love you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.